This is part 2 of Paul's review of Sepp Holzer's visits to the United States in 2013.
So, time to talk about Bozeman. And I've got two notes about the beginning of the Bozeman event. One is the story that I heard about when in fact I've got a story that probably doesn't, you know, impact too much, but Christy Nieto was there at the event, and so she said that as she was flying from Seattle to Bozeman, that she was explaining to a woman sitting next to her about what is permaculture and stuff like that, and there's this guy coming from Austria that she's going to hear speak, and the woman said, oh, the people sitting right behind us are from Austria. And so Christy jumps up in her chair and looks back, and there's Judith, and there's Sepp.
Yeah.
and so she's like waving Sepp's book at him, and Sepp's like, you know, as much as you can, some crazy English speaking woman waving your book at you. I don't know what you say to that. So anyway, she was super excited that she saw him on the plane and everything. All right, but apparently, on the plane to Bozeman, that Sepp was sitting next to the window and looking at the window, and he was really depressed about what he saw. He felt that what he saw from the plane of the Rocky Mountains was really depressing. And then as he, you know, got to Bozeman and he could look around a little bit. I mean, you know, and of course he did something similar too in when he was in Dayton, where he was saying, all the trees here are all sick. Why don't you guys do something about this? And I kind of felt like, dude, I'm totally trying to do something about it. and it's like, to him, it was so, so obvious. Everything is dying. Everything is sick. It's like 99% of the landscape is pretty much devastated, obviously, by the people living there. And then when you get into Bozeman, of course, you know, when you're in Dayton and Missoula, it's kind of green and lush compared to Bozeman.
Yeah, and there's, you know, but, you know, to that point, there, I know that with the bark beetle infestation and, you know, the trees drying out, that was a big contributor to the fires they've had there. So I think Seth's point is well taken. And I had heard the story. Judith mentioned it to me a little bit. And then I actually had the chance to talk to Christy a little bit, too. I hadn't met her before, but I got a chance to meet her at the event. And she actually showed us some beautiful, did a brief presentation. I don't know if you were there. It was like during lunch, but she gave a brief presentation of her garden. She did some really cool, beautiful stuff. But yeah, I've heard Sepp tends to like to sit near a window so he can kind of look at the landscape below and get an aerial view, you know, the Google Earth view as he's flying. And I did hear that story that he was really frustrated that, you know, especially when the problem is so easy to correct. I think that's the thing that really eats at him is that, you know, it's not like you're working in the Sahara Desert or something. There's plenty of water. You know, on the mountain ranges above Bozeman, there's plenty of water to fix this problem. You're just not allowed to touch it. And that's the thing that I think was really eating away at him.
Right. And I think that started to come out more and more through his Bozeman trip, how frustrated he was that it's like how to fix all of this is so easy.
Yeah.
But, you know, the government keeps you from fixing it.
Yeah, well, I know that's something that Zach Weiss is really going to be working on with the landowner at the property. And it's, you know, one night they actually spent there at a meeting with some of the people that have some influence over those decisions, and they were very receptive. But, you know, it's just a process, and it doesn't happen overnight, and you need to educate people, and they need to understand it because they've got, you know, particularly in the political arena, they've got constituents they got to answer to. And, you know, I think it will happen, but it's probably not going to happen overnight. And I think the frustrating thing for Sepp there is that he's like, you know, in a couple of days, I could transform this entire landscape from 50 acres of dry, rolling, flat field into a beautiful lake, a waterscape. I mean, it would just be a Garden of Eden paradise that we could transform it into in less than a week with a handful of bulldozers and not much cost, and I'm not allowed to do it. And it just, I think it eats away at him. And he's done it successfully so many times in so many different places. He knows what he's doing can work and it can really help. And to not be able to do it and have to just sit there and take it is not easy for a guy like him. So,
yeah, agreed. All right, so I'm going to set that aside and we're going to come back to that point in a little bit. But I think there's a couple of other things to go into. the next note that I have is that they had, I don't know, like it was like 50 people or so, something like that.
Yeah.
At this event, I think that they capped it at 45 and it sold out, and I don't know, maybe a couple people squeezed in on top of that. I'm not sure what happened.
We actually kept we capped it at 50, and then there was a few other support people around.
Okay. All right. I know it was sold out pretty fast. Like we did the something on Permies where we did we took like a ticket or two and put it through the book promotion engine that we have at Permies, and I think that sold out like nearly all the, I think you only had two tickets left to sell after the book promotion-ish thing.
Yeah, you were a big help in promoting that, and we thank you. You know, you definitely helped fill up the events, and we appreciate the word getting out. And, you know, that's how I found out last year through the event in Dayton. I found that out through you. And as luck would have it, it was only like 7-8 miles down the road from where, you know, my place is. So thank you again for doing that. That definitely helped us fill it up. And also, that reminds me, I have to say thank you from my friend Vic up in Fairbanks, Alaska, because he was one of the guys that won the free ticket on Permies. And he was at the California event, and he's a great guy. And he's just like, oh man, it was great. I was, you know, I never win anything. And all of a sudden, you know, I was on Permies. I thought, oh, I'll give this a shot. And he won. So he was really stoked to get the, you know, to win the free ticket. And, I told him that I knew you and that, you know, we'd hung out in Montana last year, et cetera, and you helped promote the events. And she said, all right, well, tell Paul that I said thank you personally whenever you talk to him next. So thank you from Vic and Arnold in Fairbanks for winning the free ticket. Yep.
I think it's really easy to win the tickets, and the funny thing is that it's so bizarre to me how people, when we give the tickets away, we go and we have a program that shows us 10 posts and we pick out the best 2 posts. So quality is a factor, and so then, you know, a lot of posts are like, I'm just trying to win a ticket. It's like, yeah, that one loses. and so it's like. But the funny thing is, the other requirement is if you signed up for the Daily-ish email, and it's like half the time we pick the 2 names, and one of them is not signed up for the Daily-ish email.
Yeah.
And it's like it's announced over and over and over again. So it kind of turns out to be really, really easy to win a ticket or win a book or win a DVD, and we're giving something away every week. And it just shocks me how we say this over and over and over again, and people still don't get it. So it's like, it's crazy easy to win this stuff. And so, yeah, I'm glad to hear that your buddy got in.
Yeah, and in fact, that was one thing I should have mentioned in California is Vic actually went up and showed a design to Seth, because although he lives in Fairbanks, which is one of the coldest places, it's like zone 1, you know, in the winter, zone 2. He actually has, I think it was like a 40-acre or 50-acre plot, you know, maybe half hour outside the city. And in the Alaskan wilderness, and he was talking about, I had some really interesting conversations with him about the varying levels of the terrain on his property, and how in the valley it's much colder, but then on the top of the hill, on the slopes, it's like to be like zone 3, or 3B, 3A, 3B, and down in the valley it's definitely zone 2, it can get 50 below. And so, but he had found some apple varieties, some plum varieties, you know, lots of different berries that actually grow and can still thrive in that harsh a climate. And so he had some interesting conversations with Seth about the design of that and how you would structure things. And Seth gave him references of things he'd done in Siberia, which is even colder than Alaska,
right.
And the things he'd done with, you know, creating earth berms, not hugel beds, but, you know, earth berms basically to block the wind, and then crater gardens and things like that to create varying different microclimates in a freezing cold climate and block wind. And so it was really interesting. That was another interesting part of that event, was hearing, you know, people that come from different parts of the country, from, you know, Kentucky to New York to Texas to Alaska, and Seth's thinking process, not so much the design, because the design is going to vary for each, you know, site depending on your zone, your climate, but the way that he thinks about. So it's not so much Seth teaching what, you know, what you should do for your property, but this is how you should go about thinking about what you should do for your property. And that to me was kind of interesting to see, especially in an extreme climate like, you know, Vic's place in Fairbanks.
Okay. Yeah. That is good conversation stuff. I and and growing stuff in the extremely cold areas, I mean, that is extra challenging. And when you're up there in Alaska, then one bizarre perk is that when the growing season hits, then the days are mighty long.
Oh, yeah. The sun never sets up there, basically. And it kind of goes down the horizon, but it never quite sets all the way. I experienced that in Finland last year. I was in southern Finland, and, be light out till 1 in the morning, and the sun would kind of never really go down, but it would, kind of be on the horizon like a sunset till about 3, 4 in the morning, and it would start to come up again about 5 a.m. And so it does allow you a lot more sunlight to grow your fruits and vegetables in the summer, but you still have the issue with occasional late frost. And then, of course, in the winter, how do you plant a lot of long-term perennials on a big property like that? Fruit and nut trees and berry bushes and other perennials like asparagus and stuff. How do you do that in a climate that harsh where it doesn't kill them? And he's actually done a lot of research of getting certain varieties. He's worked with the University of Minnesota, and even he got this like crab apple tree from some university in Siberia that sent him a couple of the seedlings or something. And he'd been in communication with this guy, and it was kind of interesting. He got him to grow, and so it's kind of interesting cultural exchange too. Like, okay, it doesn't get any harsher than here. What grows for you guys, and can you send me some? So that was pretty interesting.
Well, the thing is that while the growing season is short, the days are so much longer,
right,
that you're getting like a lot more sun. So your growing season is short according to the calendar, but your growing season is actually a lot longer because the days are so much longer.
Right.
So all right. So setting that aside, I'm trying to move forward with the list of things here. We've wandered off on so many tangents, and I feel like there's like 8 different things I wanted to say along the way, but screw it. Let's just get back to the list. All right. So for the event in Bozeman, they had like, 4 or 5 houses that they rented, and then people stayed in these houses. And so they had one that, they call it the Permies house, and so they said, who wants to stay with Paul and the Permies house? And apparently that was the most popular house. So I just want to say that because it makes me feel good that so many people, there's so much demand for this house. But and the other thing is that I arrived at the event sick, and it's like I'm coughing, and I still have this cough, and I can't seem to get, at least I don't have a fever anymore, but I just can't seem to stop coughing. It just goes on and on and on.
Yeah, you and Sepp both.
Yeah, and Sepp was coughing too. We were swapping different flavors of throat lozenges. Here, I've got red ones. You want to try red? And I got to say that, for the folks at my house, what an awesome group of people. And I feel like they got screwed because they showed up and they probably thought they were going to visit with me or something like that. And I really couldn't visit because I'm just coughing the whole damn time.
Yeah.
But I did get to visit with them a little bit, and it was really cool. What a wonderful group of people. And in fact, in that picture that Christy took, where we've got the rainbow in the background, and there's a bunch of us, most of the people in that picture came from my house. So we did tend to stick together a fair bit, and it was just awesome. That was a big, big perk. It's just the whole thing. We're all in one big house. And I think there's like 7 of us or something in one big house. And then a bunch of people from another house came by one night, and that was a great time.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't even know you guys had that. I wasn't aware of that. I would have stopped by one night to say hello.
Well, where did you stay?
I was actually staying with Neil Bertrando and Mark Leaf and actually the translators were there. Who else did we have there? We had, ours was a little bit of a revolving door. We had different people coming in and out. But we had a nice house. I think Zach took care of us really well. Had a nice house in Bozeman. Wasn't too far from the event and very comfortable. And, of course, the greatest perk was it had a hot tub in the back, a jacuzzi. So I would go
ours
there and sit in that thing
too
a couple nights and soak.
Ours had a hot tub too, but I'm not really a hot tub guy. We had one of the guys in our group went out there. He was having like some trouble with his back, so he went out there and did the hot tub thing a few times. But it was awesome to get up in the morning and they'd already made breakfast. And in fact, this one guy, Armin, He had like moose sausage from a moose that he had killed, and we also had moose jerky.
Nice.
And then we had anyway. There's just all kinds of food that people brought that was from their own home, and it was amazing.
Well, I got to thank Zach publicly because I felt really taken care of. We had a great place to stay. Benjamin, God bless him, he was up there to pick us up every morning. He had the minivan. We were just incredibly well taken care of. So,
yeah. So I love the accommodations. The house was beautiful. It was a big, beautiful house, and it was an eco house. We actually got to meet the builder of the house at one point and talk about, okay, what is the floor up there made out of? Because it kind of looks like cob, but it's harder than cob. And he said it's actually a special kind of, like, cement. but it's, like, hand-troweled. I think it might have been, like, a type of ferro cement.
Huh. That's interesting.
So, But anyway, cool place, and so there's. I wanted to mention that I've got it on the list of things to talk about. But let's at Bozeman, we're on a piece of property. So where the event is taking place, they've set up a tent, and they put in a rocket mass heater that had no mass. That's our heat source. Which, you know, we're in Montana in March, so. Or is it March or April? It was March. It was the end of March.
It was the end of March, yep.
Yeah. And so it's cold. But it actually was pretty warm there the whole time. It wasn't too terribly bad.
No, it wasn't.
They didn't have a mass on the rocket mass heater yet, so then the rocket mass heater wasn't working as efficiently as it could have. But all right, this piece of property is 50 acres, and it's pretty flat, a very gentle slope. Pretty much you should just call it flat. To mention slope at all seems kind of a little silly, but there is actually a little bit of slope to it.
Yeah, there is, from top to bottom. It's kind of a big rectangle, like a 50-acre rectangle with a house at the top, the top part of it, which I guess is the crow fly. I guess it would be the east part of the property, and then it kind of slopes down gently to the west.
Right, and the rectangle – or the house is at the skinny end of the rectangle. So it's like, and then the road is at the opposite from the house.
Right.
So it's like you pull off the road, you have to drive all the way across the property to get to the house.
Right.
And then along the southern edge of the property, there's a creek kind of meandering in and out of the property line.
Right.
So sometimes the creek is on the property and sometimes it's not on the property. And we're told that this creek, if it weren't being fucked with upstream, then the creek would be a year-round creek. But apparently water rights are such that this guy, when it gets to be hot, so, you know, July, sometime in July, then he just takes all the water from the creek, and he's got his own thing that he does with it.
Yeah, you know, I heard that story, and that was kind of bizarre to me, too, because here we are just right downstream, like one or two properties below that. I think the guy that was doing that was at the base of the mountains, you know, and here's Sepp saying this is some of the best waters, you know, coming right down from the mountains. It's getting mineralized on the way down, and you can't touch it. This guy upstream can touch it, but we can't touch it. Is that fair? And then apparently also that property had been bought, I guess, without water rights, which Seth had a hard time getting his head around that issue, too. So it does seem kind of strange, though. One person is able to access the water and prevent anybody else downstream from getting it, but then we're not able to touch it, or the landowner where we had the event is not able to touch it. Even when we want to do something great that would actually create a water retention scape and rehydrate the land and the soil and, you know, yada, yada. So... that was kind of confusing to me.
So, all right. So boy, there's so much to say. I mean, I got like eight things to say about what you just said, and it's like I don't know where to even begin.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to start off with like the water right. Oh, you know what? I'm going to finish what I was saying, and that is that technically, if that guy didn't take the water, it would be a year-round creek. And it's a small little creek. It's just a dribble, really. It's not, you know, it's probably, you know, 15 gallons per minute.
Yeah, I'm guessing. I mean, I think where I crossed it, it was probably 4 or 5 feet wide and maybe 2 feet deep. You think? I mean, it varies.
I would not say. I would say it was like at the one point where we kept crossing, like they put a board across it so we could walk across it, but you could jump it if you wanted to. But you had a board just to be safe. You could walk across the board.
Yeah.
And I was always worried that probably being the most jumbo guy there that I had to be careful to only step on the ends of the board, not the middle. stress testing this poor little board. But I would guess that it was about 4 inches deep, and it was probably it could be 2 feet across, 2.5 feet across. Something like that.
Maybe at that point, but there were parts further downstream where it was definitely a leak, a couple feet deep. And obviously, it varies, you know, from place to place.
Sure. But I think that, yeah, it gets deeper in spots. You know, oh, look, a little pondish thing is kind of made here, so it's all of 2 feet deep.
Yeah.
But I think at that particular point where we were going across it, it was only like 4 inches deep, and it was moving slowly.
Yeah.
Very slow. So there's other spots where the whole creek would have been like a foot wide and maybe 7 or 8 inches deep, and mm-hmm. the water would be moving a little faster.
Right.
Yeah. So, all right. So that's kind of painting a picture of the creek that we're talking about. But the key is that, like, at some point in time, this guy, he owned, like, you know, thousands of acres, and then he split it off and sold it. But he still wants his water. So he's, like, selling off the property and saying, you can have the property, but you don't get to have any water.
Right.
It sucks to be you. That's the deal. You can either buy the property without the water, and sometimes there just happens to be water going through, but you don't get to ever use any of it for irrigation or anything. That's the deal. He maintains the water right. And so, you know, the property got resold and resold and resold and resold. Now we're where we're at where we don't have, you know, this woman owns the property, but she doesn't have any water right.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense to me then. I guess that was the thing that Sepp couldn't understand. And again, this comes back to the cultural thing sometimes, you know?
Well, and this is the thing, is I explained it to Sepp twice. And it's like, but he seemed to be on a roll of being pissed off. And so I think what I said, it's like he found, plus it's like, you know, going through interpreters, it's like, I made a career out of the English language, and you go into a situation where a bunch of engineers are all trying to say this dumb fuck thing is the truth, and it's like they're just they you know, and so you have to use every tool in the English language to convince them that no, you found the worst possible interpretation of that, and so now I've now got to use all the tools in the English language to show you this other interpretation. And by the way, this other interpretation is the reality.
Right.
Whereas the one that you've been chasing so that none of your work has gotten done for the last 6 months, that one is not true.
Right. Right, wrong,
so
or indifferent.
Like, now it's like I'm trying to talk to this guy. He doesn't speak any English and I don't speak any German. And we're going through a translator who's like trying to make the best of it. And it's not getting through, and so it's a mess. It's just a mess. So I don't know. Maybe if he and I could speak the same language, then maybe I could convey this message. And it's like, you know, but it didn't get conveyed. And it seemed like any time I try to have a conversation with him, it's really, really damn near impossible. It's very challenging. So it's kind of like, all right, you make the best of it. You make the best of it. All right, so.
Yeah, I know, it's tough. It is tough. I mean, I do speak a little bit of German. It's even hard for me because, you know, I'm probably at a, you know, second grader level of vocabulary, and, you know, he's an adult. And then the nuances of various terms related to agriculture, you know.
So I know that last year there was a day where, I don't know, I said something to the group and everybody laughed and Sepp got pissed off. Because Sepp wants to, it's the Sepp Holzer show, and it's not the Paul Wheaton show. And then people asked him questions about, well, Paul said this thing, and he, so like, so then the translators came to me and said, okay, whatever you do, don't do that, because then he'll be pissy for days, and it's like, I don't want to steal the guy's stage. I don't want to steal his thunder. I don't want to do that. I've got massive respect for the guy, and I'm there to try and learn some things. And so so after a couple of days, things went back to normal and things were good again.
I know you guys were joking around at that when you were up at the Sage Mountain Center. I know he was goofing around, clowning around with you on the photos, you know, where he was shrinking, like, you know, playing David, your Goliath, and, like, kind of clowning around with you. So.
Oh, right, when you took those pictures. Yeah.
Yeah. It looked like he was having fun with you, kidding around. And, of course, you guys have your handshake, too, that you do.
Right. And you know, for most of the time, he and I get along great and everything's wonderful. But I also feel like I'm trying to ask some questions which are really important to me. And I don't know, I kind of feel like when the question gets translated, it seems like he's either the translator has translated it in such a way that it's an awful question, or he feels like there's nuance in the question and he gets defensive. And so after a while I just kind of stopped trying. It's like I don't want to be there to be like a pain in his ass, you know? I legitimately have questions that I'm curious about and I want to ask.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of felt like, wow, it's like damn near, like two times out of three I'm setting off a bomb. And so then it kind of seemed like a lot of the times he's trying to provoke me into something, and I kind of feel like I'm not taking the bait anymore, man. It seems like I take the bait, and then you get all pissed off and angry. So he's got this thing where we're all sitting around, and he's talking about he wants to build a pond there next to the house. And he keeps looking at me and saying, does anybody have any suggestions? Does anybody have any design ideas? And after about the fifth time he said it, it's like, all right, I'll tell you. And then, you know, yeah, he got all pissed off. And so my idea for that spot was, rather than trying to build something that's like 15 acres, because I think that's what he wanted, was to build a 15-acre lake,
uh-huh.
is I try to point out that it's a United States thing. So it's this. I heard this from the Department of Natural Resources. I also heard it from a couple of other federal offices. And it's like, if you're going to build a pond where the dam is 8 feet tall or less, and the size of the pond is a quarter of an acre or less, it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. And in fact, when this was told to me, the exact words were, I am not telling you that it's better to ask forgiveness than permission.
Right, but that was the inside word.
Right, so this is right from the source. These are this is from the regulators, not from the lawmakers, which I think is a very important point.
That is a very important. Actually, I kind of want to write that down. 8 feet or less and a quarter acre or less?
Right, and so I explained this to him, and it's like, and I explained it to him twice, and I said, so therefore, my design would feature a smaller pond. Now, I think a quarter acre pond is still a pretty big pond, but I mean, for the size of the thing he did at Dayton, that was like pushing 3 acres. That's not a pond. That's a lake.
Yeah.
You know, and granted, it looks like a pond when you're that close to Flathead Lake, one of the largest lakes in the United States.
Right.
So it looks smallish, but it's still, I still classify anything over 2 acres as a lake.
Right.
And so that was, you know, what he has in Dayton is over 2 acres. And in fact, I think it's miraculous that he got away with it. I just kind of feel like that's going to show up in the satellite photos. And then the Department of Making You Sad is going to show up, and they're going to be all, like, getting ugly.
Well, you know, I think it did, and the Department of Sad and Making You Sad did show up, but then they realized they couldn't touch it because it was on tribal land.
And the tribe had approved it.
And the tribe approved it, yeah. I heard something about that. Maybe it was from you, somebody.
Yeah, and then the tribe went to bat for Katerina, the woman who owns that property.
Right.
And it's like, no, we say it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, and so they had to back off. So it's like, phew.
Yeah.
But my impression was, and I from the stories that I heard over the months that passed, that for a while the tribe was, you know, but we already talked about that a little bit. They're a little upset, but I think once everything started to grow in, then they're like, oh, no, this is cool.
Yeah, it's on the light.
So anyway, everything worked out on that process. But now we're in an area where, we're in I think it's Gallatin County, which contains the city of Bozeman. So there's, a fair amount of population. And so then it's like, well, what's the county going to say? And then when you're making a pond, I think that my impression is there's like 20 different departments, I think even more than 20 different departments, that technically say they must be notified before you build a pond. And I don't know what all of them are. But my impression is about half of them are going to say yes, and there's going to be like two of them where we'll even give you money to build a pond. And then there's going to be several that are going to say, we'll think about it, and eventually they'll say no.
Right.
And then there's going to be a few, very few, that are going to – their answer is going to be, we're so glad you applied. The answer is no. And now we're going to monitor your property, and if you ever do build anything, we already have it thoroughly documented that we told you no. And we are prepared to make you extremely sad.
Exactly. Yeah. That.
And so it's kind of like, why can't you guys all? Why can't you guys talk to the guys over there that are going to pay me to build this pond, and like get it all worked out? Why can't there be a department of ponds? And but no, that's not how it works. I mean, they're already fighting amongst each other about this stuff. But the bottom line is that. And so then my suggestion went on. So I said, build the pond. If you're ever going to be caught, and by the way, it's all complaint driven. So somebody would have to complain. They would have to come out and observe the pond. They would be bored to death observing it.
Right.
And then there's going to be questions. There's going to be a question about what is your benefit from this pond? And now my understanding is, and I got, and this is from a call that I once had from, I think it was the Department of Natural Resources, where a complaint was made against one of my ponds that I had out on Mount Spokane. And the interesting thing is the guy's kind of like, telling me the answers to the questions. And so basically the thing is that if you derive any benefit, then I have to tell you to take the pond out. Now, let me ask you, do you derive any benefit?
Wow.
And he was telling me, like, benefit would include, oh, it's beautiful. Benefit would include, I'm raising fish in it. Benefit would include, like, fire suppression. In case there's a fire, I've got a lot of water here to help put the fire out.
Yeah, it kind of shows you how weird the laws are. Like, what, the government doesn't want you to derive any benefit? Like, why would that be a criteria? That if you derive benefit, I guess in the legalese.
Water rights. Who knows? There's all kinds of crazy going on the other side of the people who make the laws.
Yeah.
The key is that if it's something like I had the track hoe that day. I wanted to see if I could do it, and now it's done, and now I don't know why it's there. Just a moment of crazy, a bit of a lark, and now it exists. And I actually stare out the other way to trees, and I don't ever look at the pond. I don't know what to do with it. Well, then that's totally okay. You get to keep the pond.
That's funny.
So anyway, I mean, the guy who was calling me up. I mean, I know who called him. It was my Aryan neighbor, and so I thought the guy who called was totally cool. But of course, not everybody that works for the department making you sad is going to be cool,
right?
And it's like, okay, we got the anonymous complaint. which I understand you can contest that. You can say, there's no such thing as an anonymous complaint. You got to tell me who complained. It's the law. But okay, these places are complaint-driven. And so they get the complaint. They have to, like, you know, resolve it, or at least try.
Sure.
You know, and I think that's part of it, too. I tried to resolve it, and I put some time into it, and I'm waiting for a call back, and I forgot about it. So,
and you're fine.
So the thing I said to SEP was, all right, so we don't want there to be that complaint. And there's only one house in all this area that could possibly see the pond. So let's put up a berm between the pond and that house. So there, you know, we've eliminated the vector. Now, granted, if people come to the house and they drive up the driveway and they see the pond, then they could say something like, hi, we're here to sell you Amway stuff and tell you about Jesus. And, you know, we brought some Mary Kay products with us, too. And then they see the pond and you slam the door in their face. Fuck off. Then they're like, we see the pond. We've decided to call the Department of Making You Sad because we didn't like you slamming the door in our face. That is an additional vector, and maybe you want to mitigate that one too. I don't know. But the key is it's like, build the pond, put it in, quarter acre, dam, 8 foot tall. Hell, by looking at the land, I was thinking that if you had a dam 6.5 feet tall, at 6.5 feet tall dam, that would be fine.
Yeah, that's interesting perspective, Paul. If that's true, then and you stayed well below the 8 feet and the quarter acre. You know, my gosh, that seems like that's a manageable risk, you know, and especially if you did put the earth berm to block a view of it, and these things are complaint-driven, if no one can see it, and nobody knows it's there, and only one neighbor would be able to see it, but they're blocked from seeing it because of the earth berm, you know, and if you have a good relationship with that neighbor, it seems to me like that would be a manageable risk to be worth taking.
Well, and that was another thing, too, is we were talking about, you know, the relationships with the neighbors and stuff like that. And I kind of think relationships change, you know, and I think you need to embrace that. And so they were talking about, let's go ask the neighbors if they think it's okay if we do things on their land. And I'm kind of thinking, like, can't we do projects and not? I mean, we've got 50 acres here. You know, can we do projects and not go onto the neighbor's land?
Right.
You know, and I'm kind of thinking, like, why trigger the possible call to the Department of Making You Sad out of all this?
Yes.
And we got 50 acres to work with here. Let's just do our projects in such a space that, you know, that's not an issue.
Yes. So I would have to agree with you.
So that was you know, the other thing is that. Something that's smaller than a quarter of an acre would still be way bigger than most swimming pools. You could do a natural swimming pool. Wouldn't that be awesome?
You could, you know. There's so much potential. I mean, just in light of what you just said, it seems to me like you could get away with building a whole bunch of small ponds with dams that are below 8 feet, and then just, you know, I mean, if you have, you know, one pond that's 1 acre or 10 ponds that are a tenth of an acre, it's the same, essentially the same water mass, you know, could you work around the laws? And that's something SEP's always been really good at. So, you know, who knows? Maybe that was a translation issue. Maybe the property owner still felt uncomfortable with that. Or, you know, there's the possibility that, you know, it sounded to me like the property owner wanted to do what SEP had recommended with the big lake, do the grand project. Most of his projects, he always goes for the grand project and then scales it back from there if he can't do it. But I think she wanted to do the grand project. And, you know, the one time I talked to her, she seemed to think that she could get approval to do it, but it's going to take like a year or 6 months. And
that
people are open. So rather than do a half-ass thing right now, let's just wait a little bit, be patient. I'll bring you back next year, Steph, and we'll do it right. I'll have the approvals, and there'll be nothing to stop us.
So I was along those lines, I was looking at a property a few days ago, and by the way, I'm under contract to buy 200 acres. So hopefully it'll close, and I'll have 200 acres to work with to do my art my way.
Yeah, I saw that. Congratulations, man. That's exciting. That's a big piece of land. That's very exciting.
Seeing how the last one failed on closing day, I'm not counting my chickens before they're hatched here. Although in this case, it's like the party on the other end is a timber company, so it kind of seems like I can't imagine anything being crazy.
Right.
I imagine it's going to all go like clockwork. And knock on wood. I'm knocking on some wood here. So we'll see, and hopefully, and then of course, it's like I should make a whole other podcast at some point about the people coming onto the land and all the projects we're going to do. And I know that there's been I think there's been over 50 people that have said, the moment you have land, I'm moving on with you, and we're going to do things. And it's like, no, okay, so it's getting to be that time. I think the time is near. But that's another topic for another day. But the key I was saying is that this real estate agent woman that was showing us, it's like, because we're doing this in a county that's outside of Missoula County.
Uh-huh.
And we're specifically, I mean, the reason why the land hunt is taking so long is because we're doing it outside of these counties where they have a large department of making you sad. And so this the woman, the real estate agent, says, oh, yeah, I went and I put this special kind of addition onto my house. And I can't even remember what she called it, a thus-and-so window. It wasn't a bay window. It was something else. She says, but here it was $2,500, and it was all done within 5 days.
Huh.
And then my mom lives in Missoula and decided to have the exact same thing done. It took 8 months to get all the permits and stuff. And then, you know, it cost her an extra $1,200 for the permits, plus all the dirt that came from digging had to be hauled to the dump. She was forbidden to keep the dirt on her property and, like, put it in her garden or something like that.
Wow.
That was against the law. And so it's kind of like now, like, Bozeman is in a county, much like Missoula County, where it's like, oh, yeah, we've got to give permits and regulate, and we got to come out and hold a ruler up to it, and we got to monitor things we don't understand. So, like, I mean, it's not like the people in Bozeman that do all the regulating, it's not like they have any clue what SEP does. They cannot begin to fathom to understand what SEP is up to.
Yeah, but it's like a foreign language to them. And that's why a big part of it, and SEP talked about this, too, over the course of the workshop when I was traveling with him, he mentioned a bunch of times that the urgent need to educate the policymakers and officials that govern these sorts of things. Because, this is a real, real stumbling block. It's a real hurdle. And if we can get more of them on our side, things could happen a lot quickly, and it's to the benefit of all. So, our friend Jack Spirico, we mentioned, too. I mean, he's talked about this before in his podcast, where if you're looking for land, what a difference it can make if you're in, outside the city in an unincorporated area, or in an area where you're not in, say, for example, a housing community or something. All those things add potential regulation hassles and increase the risk of the Department of Making You Sad show up and, creating pain in your life. So, it seems to me like the more rural areas you get, the less likely you are to be hassled and with those types of things. So, in a city where there's a lot of people, there's a lot of more factors to consider, and everyone kind of gets their hand in the cookie jar and things get convoluted and confused. So,
see, now, this comes back to those podcasts that I made with Art Ludwig, where Art Ludwig, the point is whatever you do, do not talk to the regulators. What you do is you do it illegally, and then you talk to the legislators.
Yeah, I kind of remember that now you say that.
Yeah, and so SEP kept saying, no, you got to take it to the regulators, and you got to show them, and it's like, that doesn't do shit, because they're not paid to, like, wrap their heads around what you're doing and like, say, oh, well, then that's cool. I mean, I think a lot of the people that are the regulators, I mean, it's like when Ernie and Erica were working on the rocket mass heater getting put into the building codes for Portland, then the guy that comes out from the Department of Making You Sad was really cool, and he's like, trying to prompt Ernie and Erica to be able to, like, work it in this way. And it's like, okay, is it your only heat source? And he's kind of looking at him like the answer is yes, you know? And they're like, no, we got electric too. So
help me help you.
Yes, help me help you here, because this is, because what you have here is so fucking awesome. But you know, but there are ways that it can be here. It's a, there are ways that it can be allowed. So you know, then there was some other question too about being an antique or something like that, and it's like, well, of course it's not an antique. You know, of course, well, you could argue that it's like based on mud, which is from thousands of years ago. I don't know, but the correct, yeah. So, but it's like, of course, Ernie and Erica answered everything totally honestly, which of course is entirely appropriate. And if they had known, maybe they would have, I don't know, sold their electric heaters because they didn't need them, and now they only have one source of heat. But they didn't. So
all the nuances of regulation.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, you want to – so basically the way – I mean, there's what the laws say, and there's like, you know, how many – like what is it? Three-quarters of the law is probably ignored every day, mostly because people haven't even bothered to read. There's just so many. There's like no way we can do anything without breaking a law. So, and then there's like the what laws are enforced, and so how are things done? People are still building ponds, and so it's still going on, and it's like, okay, so how do you do this in a way that like works out to be okay?
Right.
And that's really what it is. And so basically the bottom line is better to ask, if it's of this certain size, better to ask forgiveness than permission. So it's like, even if they come to you and they say, okay, you know, you're, it's possible they might say you have to take it out. But it's also possible that if you know how to answer the questions, then it's also possible that they'll say, okay, we're going to fine you $400. And it's like, no problem. In fact, somebody was telling me a story like just 3 or 4 days ago about how this guy went and built a pond, and it was like 5 acres. And it's this huge, massive pond, and they came out, and it's like apparently they went through 6 months of arguing back and forth with these departments, and then finally the departments came back and said, okay, you know, we've decided, it's all done, you're now going to be fined, and what's the fine? $500. So the guy is kind of thinking, I've just spent $20,000 on lawyers with you guys.
I'll pay the damn fine, just leave me alone.
Why couldn't you tell me from the very beginning that there's like the maximum fine is $500? I would have just written you a check, and then that we would have been done. It's like,
yeah.
And but $500 for a fine, but it's like maybe the permitting process would have been thousands of dollars.
Well, you know, it's like in your point, everything you're saying makes sense. I think, you know, in this case, specific to Bozeman again, I remember talking to Neil Petrando, and he was saying that places where he's worked that, you know, the fines can be as high as like $3,000 to $10,000, even one place was $10,000 a day until you change it. And, you know, I think that's probably on the very high end, but I think, you know, I would be nervous as a property owner unless if I really didn't know it for certain. I would be a little nervous, but I do think I might have rolled the dice on your thing about, hey, keep it below 8 feet on the dam, make it a quarter acre or less, and then do the earth burn thing so nobody sees it. To me, that, and then you kind of do a parallel path and work to get the, you know, through the proper channels for permitting and so forth as you do this. And probably by the time it got to someplace, you're either going to get the approval to do what you want, or they're going to say, well, no, you can't do that, but, you know, your current thing is underneath our, you know, minimum restrictions, so there's no problem. So to me, that's a manageable risk, but, you know, who knows? I don't know all the...
I think an important key out of this is that this creek where they would have built this is, for practical purposes, for what they're doing, is a seasonal creek because the guy takes all the water in July and August. I mean, the whole creek just stops.
Right.
It's just dry. And he takes all the water for July and August.
Yep.
And so therefore, there's not fish in it. Because if there were fish in the creek, they would all die in July and August as all the water is gone.
Right.
So it's this creek has artificially been made into a seasonal creek. Then the next thing is it's like, okay, if you build a pond and you don't have any water running into it, then the pond will go funky, nasty quickly.
Right.
And so, you know, it's like, okay, the next step is that either you got to keep water circulating in that pond somehow. And there are ways. There's techniques. One way is that if you build your natural swimming pool, then you'll have a pump in there that'll be circulating the water through a bunch of plants and stuff like that.
Right, and it's help clean it.
But the other thing is that it's quite plausible that the creek hasn't actually dried up completely, but that there's still a fair bit of flow, only it's like 2 or 3 feet below the surface. And then the question becomes like, okay, what do we do to get that to come back up above the surface? And I think that that's an entirely valid question to be asking, and it's something to try and figure out and resolve.
Yep.
So,
you know, and there's so many moving parts. I mean, it really, you just need to study it up front before you're ready to do something like that. I mean, I remember reading something years ago in the Flathead area where it's like they were giving all these restrictions on fish ponds, private fish ponds, and then they're like, however, if you're going to raise brown trout because they're an endangered species, you know, you can do whatever you want, man. As long as you're doing brown trout, we want more brown trout. That was like the big issue that year, you know, and so it was pretty much a lot of the restrictions kind of fell away as long as you were raising brown trout because of the danger of extinction of brown trout in that part of Montana. So, you know, there's
right.
so many nuances to it. I think the takeaway is you got to do your homework up front. And then, like you said, you know, and especially what's really intriguing, what you said is that you talked to like the regulator, not the legislator. If the regulator's
yeah.
saying, look, as long as it's under this and smaller than this, you know, and it's only complaint-driven, I think those are parameters that I'd be willing to roll with dice and work with that.
Well, the other thing, I mean, with the regulators, sometimes a regulator will be really cool, really awesome, and it's like, you know, they want to live in the community and they want to get along with people. They don't want to be the bad guy. Other times you get a regulator and they're a total dick. And they're gonna just and they're gonna you know and sometimes the regulator that's being a dick is like is saying, hey, you got to do $10,000 a day and you got to rip that dam out or $10,000 a day until you rip the dam out or whatever like that, and it could turn out to be that the regulator just knows you're not gonna go look at the law, and the regulator knows that that's not actually following the law.
Yeah.
But that's like you know, it's the regulator is like just you know, working it. Just for because the regulator's a dick. So sometimes they're cool, sometimes they're not, and it's a complicated, mixed up, crazy world that we live in, and you know, so but I think it's whatever you do, if you do nothing at all and your life is extremely empty, all you do is watch sports and go shopping at the mall, and you just stay in this little area that's been regulated to say this is where you're allowed to exist, then that's okay. You won't get in any trouble.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like the moment that you try to live large and live your life and actually change the world, well, that's against the law.
Yeah.
And so
because it is an important issue, because like Sepp says in the video, and he says in his books, the hydrology is 70% of the equation. And if you get that right, a lot of other things become really easy. And if you get that wrong, you know, there are other techniques, which you've obviously, you know, preached upon, you know, hugel beds and swales. There's lots of different low irrigation techniques. But, my gosh, if you can do – you get the water landscape right, and you got a water feature that's hydrating that soil, everything else becomes easier. And if you don't get that right, you know, you can have just – consistent soil degradation and dry landscapes and so forth. So it is a big equation, and you know, it's also different in every part of the country. So it's something you definitely want to investigate up front.
All right, Bill, I'm going to suggest that we stop recording this podcast now, and that we take a bio break, and that we continue recording podcast stuff here in a few minutes. Does that sound all right?
That sounds good.
All right. And so I'm gonna guess that this is going to be a good break time for like dividing up the podcast. So I'm going to say, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about building ponds, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.